Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Carol White, and I'm the Senior Curator of Antiquities here at the Getty Villa. It gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker for this afternoon's lecture, Dr. Kathleen Stewart Howe. Dr. Howe is the guest curator of our current exhibition, In Search of Biblical Lands. And when we were in the early stages of planning this show, we could think of no one better or more qualified, short of our own curators in the Department of Photographs, who could take this fascinating group of images and shape a thought-provoking and engaging narrative around them. Dr. Howe is the Sarah Rempel and Herbert S. Rempel Director of the Pomona College Museum of Art and also a professor of art history at Pomona College. She received her academic training in the history of photography at the University of New Mexico. And prior to taking on her position at the Pomona College Museum of Art, Dr. Howe was the interim associate director at the University of New Mexico Art Museum. Dr. Howe is an extremely active museum professional, having curated more than 40 exhibitions over the past 15 years. Some of the more recent ones at the Pomona College Museum of Art, some of which you may have seen, include last year's Helen Pashkian, Working in Light, and in 2007, Hunches, Geometrics, Organics, paintings by Frederick Hammersley, both of which had accompanying catalogs written by Dr. Howe. Other exhibitions she has curated at Pomona include shows on Kara Walker in 2008 and on James Turrell in 2007-2008. She has also curated critically acclaimed exhibitions at the Santa Barbara Museum of Art, including First Scene, Photographs of the World's Peoples in 2004, and in 1997, an exhibition on a topic related to our own In Search of Biblical Lands, a show called Revealing the Holy Land, the Photographic Exploration of Palestine. Her earlier work at Santa Barbara with this material, as well as other early photographs of the Mediterranean regions, provided her with the deep background necessary to embrace the materials on view here at the Getty Villa, which, with the exception of a single work loaned from the Claremont Colleges, is drawn from the museum's holdings in the Department of Photographs and the Getty Research Institute's special collections. And we are grateful to our colleagues in these two departments for the work they did with Dr. Howe to select and prepare these amazing photographs. In her lecture today, entitled Traveling Through Bible Lands, The Dream and the Reality, Dr. Howe explores in depth one of the themes of our exhibition, what the tourists journeying to the Holy Land imagined they would find, and the reality that confronted them when they arrived. Please join me in welcoming Kathleen Stewart Howe to the Getty Villa.
Thank you, Carol, and thank you all for being here on sort of cloudy and overcast day. My talk today really just explores one strand of the skein of desires, associations, and interests, both personal and national, that gave rise to the thousands of photographs made in the Holy Land in the second half of the 19th century. What I'm going to present today is one part of the story, but by no means the only story that's followed in the exhibition that's now on display in the galleries. I want to talk about the cluster of associations connecting photography and tourism and a specific sense of national identity for British and American visitors that was centered on Palestine, a small area of the Ottoman Empire, really the western edge of the province of Syria, and known to its visitors as the Holy Land. Now, there are in collections and libraries, in attics and family albums, perhaps maybe in your attic or your family albums, an enormous number of photographs made between 1840 and the early 1900s in Palestine. Historians of photography have made enormous progress in trying to sketch out a history of photography in the region. Who was making the photographs? In what locations? Under what circumstances? For what audience or what market? And although discoveries are still being made and mysteries still occasionally confound us, we have a pretty good handle on how photography was used in the area. But as I looked through the hundreds of photographs in the collections of the GRI and the museum, I found myself struck by the profound changes that were revealed in successive photographs of the area. not just changes with a new building here or a different occupant in a storefront, but changes in how people consumed or used their travels in the Holy Land. And it was brought home to me that photography had not only recorded physical changes, but that in fact it had served as a catalyst for a lot of those changes. And to move it from the abstract to the specific, the question I asked was, how did this photograph, a haunting view of the Dome of the Rock dominating the skyline of Jerusalem, made by the Reverend Graham in 1857 and utilizing one of the earliest photographic processes, how did this photograph lead 25 years later to this photograph made by a commercial photographer outside the Jaffa Gate in about 1880? Well, the Reverend Graham came to Jerusalem as a missionary from Scotland in 1855 and practiced during the 3 years that he lived in Jerusalem an early form of photography, the calotype process. He was an amateur of photography in the true sense of the word, meaning a lover of, one passionately devoted to an avocation without any expectation of recompense. The calotype process he used is the earliest of the negative-positive photographic processes and the progenitor of our modern photography. It required that a practitioner relying on published descriptions, or perhaps after having a personal lesson from one of the pioneers of photography, that he learn how to mix his own photographic chemicals. There were no pre-mixed solutions available. That he had to prepare a negative by soaking a piece of high-quality drawing paper in this solution he or she had just cooked up. This was the negative that was exposed in the camera. After exposure, the paper negative would be developed, again, mixing up chemicals. And if everything worked, if the chemical solutions were correctly prepared, if the exposure was correctly calculated, and bearing in mind that changes in air temperature and humidity, as well as the purity or strength of the different chemical compounds at hand, or the cleanliness of the water, all of those things factored in, then if everything had worked, you might have a negative strong enough to be printed onto another sheet of paper, which you also would painstakingly prepare by hand, and finally be able to fix. That's where these final photographic prints come from. It's a process worked out and publicized by William Henry Fox Talbot in 1839, and as you can tell, it was an arduous undertaking. The results could seem almost ethereal, as the fibers in the paper of the negative and the paper of the print combined to soften detail, and the gradual loss of chemical sensitivity towards the edges of the paper caused the image to seem to dissolve and become vaporous at the margins. In Graham's print, the band of structures dominated by the solid bulk of the Dome of the Rock seemed to float between a hazy mass of hills in the background and the blurred structures in the foreground. 25 years later, Felix Bonfi, the proprietor of a thriving photographic business based in Beirut, a studio known for the range and quality of Middle Eastern views, made this photograph near the Jaffa Gate in Jerusalem. In crisp detail, the photograph records the texture of the masonry, the sag of the shop awnings, and in the left of the image, the clearly legible sign for Cook's Tourist Office. The cook is, of course, Thomas Cook, the English entrepreneur behind the package tourism industry, which changed the face of travel. It's a company that's still in existence, still offering package tours and traveler's checks, which were another of Thomas Cook's innovations. Obviously, there's been a significant advance in the technology between the two views, although both use essentially the same camera, similar lens technology, and the same negative-positive process. Bonfils, however, made his photograph on a glass plate negative and printed it onto shiny albumen paper, both technical advances that preserved the crisp detail of the lens. But other than the obvious difference in appearance between the early paper process and the commercial glass plate technology, between the amateur struggling with an incompletely understood process and a seasoned professional deploying standardized tools of the trade, these two photographs speak to significant changes in Jerusalem. A short answer to what happened between the two views of Jerusalem might be this: tens of thousands of photographs had been produced and disseminated in those 25 years. Photographs that were saved in albums or presented in books, sold as individual prints, or as stereo cards. And we'll return to stereo cards a bit later. And also, thousands of tourists had visited the Holy Land. In fact, between 1868 and 1880, 18,000 tourists, and by this I mean those traveling with a tour group, a package tour group, had visited Palestine. When you consider that this is steamship travel and difficult travel conditions, it's truly a remarkable number. This created a back and forth between photographic image and visitor, in which pictures introduced places and shaped expectations as they fostered a market for travel, both virtual and physical. I would argue that these two factors, photography of the Holy Land and an increasing pattern of travel to the Holy Land, form an interlocking system that determined really the experience of the Holy Land, contributing to the general knowledge of the region and to some extent changing its appearance. Photography encouraged touristic travel, and tourism consumed photography. How did photographs come to have that effect? Well, in these four small views I show you here, you can see that it was a new medium that provided records, records bearing the presumption of truth, pictures don't lie, and records of the nearby and distant. On the upper left, you see Talbot's library, and next to it, a view from Daguerre's studio window. Below it, Calvert Jones' view of the Colosseum, Baron Gros's view of the Acropolis, all made within the first 3 or 4 years after the medium was introduced. It was also a medium that fueled expectations and fostered desires. People learned what to expect on a street in Jerusalem because they had seen it in photographs. This is a photograph of the stairs leading to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And one thing I should point out is that every photograph that you see in the exhibition was posed. This is not snapshot photography. These are long exposures, carefully done with a camera that required extensive setup. So even the most casual appearing photograph has been, if you will, cast, sometimes set decorated, to give you the view that the photographer wished. Photographs could also encourage you to travel. The desire to experience a place could be amplified by seeing the photographs of that place, and especially when the photographer was careful to include travelers in his view. The carefully posed Victorian ladies in Francis Frith's Views of Egypt in 1858 were proof that travel for, I quote, gentle women and gentle men was possible. But let's return to 1839 and to Palestine. Palestine was then in the midst of a period in which travel and access by Westerners was relatively open. The Egyptian Pasha Mehmet Ali had usurped control of the area from the Ottoman Sultan in 1831, and the Egyptian Pasha was interested in connecting with the benefits of European trade and technology. He actively pursued Western connections. It's under him that the germ for the idea of the Suez Canal begins. And as a result, permission to travel in the area was relatively freely given. Previously, travel had been rather arbitrary. If you arrived in Jerusalem, you may be able to travel outside the city, but then again, maybe not. So under the Egyptian control of the area, travel was assumed possible. In 1839 is also the year in which the process to make and preserve the image of a lens is announced simultaneously by our two quote-unquote inventors, and their announcements were quickly followed by the descriptions of similar techniques by two, perhaps as many as five, different inventors, all working at the same time in different places. The two dominant players, the Frenchman Daguerre and the Englishman Talbot, separately announced this achievement and demonstrated it to the public in the summer of 1839 in Paris and London, respectively. By mid-August 1839, Daguerre's directions were published, and Talbot was instructing friends and acquaintances, and Talbot was also seeking a patent for his process, making it possible for a large number of people to make photographs. In 1839, Edward Robinson, the American scholar who changed the shape of biblical study, was traveling in Palestine. He would publish the landmark Biblical Researches in Palestine, Mount Sinai, and Arabia the following year. Robinson's signal contribution was to provide a detailed historical geography of Palestine that connected surface topography, mapping, anchored by an analysis of Arabic place names, and anchoring that all to biblical narrative. His work supplanted what he described, and I quote, as the mass of topographic tradition fastened upon the Holy Land by foreign ecclesiastics and monks. And he was never complimentary of foreign ecclesiastics and monks. And he instead said that what he substituted was the ordinary tradition or preservation of ancient names among native populations, and that his work was, and I quote, a first attempt to lay open the treasures of biblical geography and history still remaining in the Holy Land, treasures which have lain for ages unexplored and had been covered with dust and rubbish. Close quote. Robinson's work provided a platform from which other scholars could relate findings derived from the ongoing textual study of early manuscript versions of the Bible with the topography of Palestine. It also provided non-scholars a way to connect with the places of the Bible identified scientifically, and it allowed Protestants who were extremely suspicious of places marked by Catholic or Eastern Rite shrines to identify, quote, the true sacred sites. As biblical scholarship provided an increasingly detailed analysis of the spaces of the Holy Land, Protestant and evangelical travelers could visit and connect with biblical sites without feeling that they were supporting or recognizing a pilgrimage economy based, in their sense, on superstition. And also traveling in the region in 1839, and I don't think they ran into each other, was David Roberts, a Scots painter who was busily filling sketchbooks with views of the Middle East, including the Holy Land, which, when he returned, were the basis for a number of paintings and a lavishly produced set of lithographs, one of which is hanging in the gallery. This type of image, a landscape filtered through an artist's eye and amended with local color, he's even added a palm tree or two in this area, was the standard against which photography would be judged. And the last of the November, the 1839 dates, I promise, is November of 1839, when there were not one, but two young men in Jerusalem with Daguerre's cameras and processes making the first photographs of the city. We think it was probably the Frenchman Goupil Fesquet who made the daguerreotype of this view of Jerusalem that was transformed into a printing plate to produce an engraving, a direct photo reproduction, published in one of the earliest books based on the photograph, The Excursions Daguerrean, and a copy is in the gallery. These first views were followed
by a virtual avalanche of photographs, and it's worth stopping here to ask what people photographed and what they sought and found in the photographs. First, we should recognize that Jerusalem and the Holy Land had a vivid visual presence in the imaginations of most of their visitors. Jerusalem was the shining city on the hill. The Holy Land was the promised land, the land of milk and honey. It was the center of religious veneration for three great religions, the place where the narratives of Old and New Testament were played out. Yet visitors to Jerusalem in 1848 saw what appeared to be, and I quote, the chief town of a poor Turkish province, close quote. For a place with such a resonant presence in people's mind, a place represented in paintings illustrating sacred events, the realities that visitors found and that photographers focused their lens on was very different. It wasn't grand or even very visually appealing. As Mark Twain said, and Twain himself was traveling with one of the first package tours in 1869, one organized by the Reverend Beecher, and I quote, "Of all the lands there are for dismal scenery, I think Palestine must be the prince. The hills are barren, they are dull of color, they are unpicturesque in shape. The valleys are unsightly deserts fringed with feeble vegetation that has an expression on it of being sorrowful and despondent. It is a hopeless, dreary, heartbroken land." Doesn't he sound like he was having a good time? Twain's dispatches were actually, he was under commission from a San Francisco newspaper to write dispatches of this first trip through the Middle East and to the Holy Land, and the works were later collected as Innocents Abroad, and Twain's very particular and jaundiced view is apparent throughout. Well, Twain's description would make any photographer despair of making exciting landscape photographs. And I show you here Francis Frith's photograph of Jerusalem from the Mount of Olives, made in about 1857. It was clear that photographers had to work with what was there, not what was in people's minds. And so how could Frith and photographers like him compete with earlier illustrations and with people's assumptions? Well, the answer was by playing photography's trump card, the claim to truthfulness. And in Frith's words, he says, "Nowhere in this series do we so fully recognize the peculiar excellence of photography as in the view before us. In it, we have the very reflection of Jerusalem, and as with a much-loved face, such a truthful record is of more value than the most elaborately beautiful picture." For a site such as the Holy Land, the ability to connect the absolute reality of a place, even if the city had shrunk within its medieval walls, and I show you a photograph by Bonfi of the Damascus Gate, or if the areas within the walls were covered with rubble, it was still Jerusalem. Travel accounts might report their shock at how small and desolate the city seemed, and I'm going to quote from Andrew Thompson traveling in 1869. "But it's remarkable what rude shocks one's meditations experience when traveling in Palestine. No sooner had we reached the Jaffa Gate by which we were to enter this wondrous city which had occupied the waking dreams of a lifetime than we were stopped by the jabbering of custom house officers eager for bribes and kept waiting long under a broiling sun until the veracity was satisfied. We then descended through narrow, steep streets on loose, flinty stones on which it was next to impossible for our horses to find solid footing. And after passing under some gloomy arcades into which the sunlight never penetrates, landed at the door of a little inn with scarcely a window on its outside wall and which had very much the look of a prison. It was enough. We were in Jerusalem." Twain himself, in trying to describe the effect of Jerusalem, said, "A fast walker could go outside the walls of Jerusalem and walk entirely around the city in an hour. I do not know how else to make one understand how very, very small it is." But Jerusalem and the sites in Palestine were ingrained in the minds of visitors who could call on years of biblical stories as children and perhaps adult Bible reading or Bible classes as adult. No matter the at times bleak reality, they quickly found a way to kind of recalibrate their expectations, searching for echoes of the stories that they had known. I'm going to quote from Edward Robinson. "The feelings of a Christian traveler on approaching Jerusalem can be better conceived than described. From the earliest childhood, I had read of and studied the locations of this sacred spot. Now I beheld them with my own eyes, and they all seemed familiar to me, as if the realization of a former dream. I seemed to be again among cherished scenes of childhood, long unvisited indeed, but distinctly recollected. And it was almost a painful interruption when my companion, who had been here before, began to point out and name the various objects of view." Or perhaps they found proof of scripture in the very appearance of the place, such as that noted by Frank de Haas in 1880. He says, "Those who feel disappointed in the wretched state of Jerusalem forget that according to prophecy, the place was to be laid waste and become a heap of rubbish, and that if it presented any other appearance than it does, it would lose all interest to the Christian, as it would falsify the predictions concerning it." All of these are strategies to try to come to grips with the expectation of what you're going to find on this enormous journey you've undertaken, and to find it so very, very different. When travelers entered Jerusalem, they found an ancient city where any excavation or intervention revealed layers of history. This view from 1857 is of one of the sites associated with the Ecce Homo Arch, the place where Pilate presented the scourged Christ to the mob and said, "Ecce Homo, behold the man." There were, in fact, two other touted candidates for that designation. His photograph, I think, accurately reveals the layers of habitation and history. Ancient streets ran 20 or 30 feet below the current street level, and older walls were the foundations of newer structures. This view is actually one of the few pictures that also shows the layers of the city's inhabitants. In it, you see Arab workmen, Ottoman administrator, Western visitor, and even a Western woman. Most photographers, when they photographed the people in the region, preferred to find types that could be readily associated with biblical stories, such as these, lepers photographed outside the city wall. Every photographic album I saw, well, that's an exaggeration. Most of the photographic albums I saw always had their leper picture. There must have been a box office sale of leper pictures. So for many, the initial disappointment at the sight of a rather bedraggled-looking Jerusalem was replaced by euphoria because they had arrived at this much-loved and well-known site, and then was again disrupted by the gap between reality and expectation when they journeyed inside the city. Nowhere more pronounced than at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which was already viewed with some suspicion by Protestant travelers because of the heavily Catholic and Eastern Rite presences within the church. But the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, assumed to be the most sacred space in Christianity, if you came from Europe and expected to see a grand cathedral, this was an extraordinary deflation, let me say. It's a huge church, but it's embedded in the very fabric of the city. There's no grand entrance up to the portal of the church. And in fact, when you get to the doors, you find that one is blocked up. The keys are held by a Muslim gatekeeper because the interior of the church is divided between or among all of the various denominations, sects that were present at the time. There's an Armenian chapel, a Greek chapel, a Franciscan chapel, a Dominican chapel, a Coptic chapel. And in fact, the guards were frequently called on to break up arguments between the Christian sects over who had precedence over what space. The bulk of the tourists found this disconcerting, to say the very least. They also found that many of the associations and the shrines and altars of older religious organizations were distinctly off-putting, and their accounts are full of critical and hostile remarks. The Garden of Gethsemane threw them for a loop. This was the site of the beginning of the Passion of Christ, yet under the care of the Franciscan monks, it had been turned into quite a lovely formal garden with little fences and gravel paths and didn't quite fit the image of what people expected to see. The idea of ornamentation was disliked by many of the visitors, and the standard admittance fees was met, of course, with frequent criticism. Almost all of them remarked on the presence of vendors, and here the plaza in front of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre with vendors selling olive wood rosaries and various souvenirs. They resented this, and they also bought a lot of stuff, with a lot of head shaking. In fact, as more people came to the Holy Land and came in these clearly defined groups, carrying guidebooks, a whole business climate grew up supporting their visits. The travel guides at the time tell you where the best place is to go to buy photographs, where the best place is to buy this or that keepsake. And I show you here this sign here, Bulos Mayo, which was an antiquity shop and a souvenir shop. It finally closed, I think, in the late or mid-1990s, but it produced this wonderful, wonderful little album that is on view in the gallery. In it, photographs that have been colorized, there is no color film at this point in the technology, are paired with dried flower collages, the idea being that the view of Bethlehem on the page opposite would have a flower collage from flowers picked at the very site. The sense was that you had something tangible. The covers were olive wood. It was literally a piece of the Holy Land that you brought home with you. If you go to the exhibition website, there's a link that would allow you to electronically page through the entire album. It's really quite lovely. And when you see it in the gallery, the color of the collaged flowers is so bright, it looks as if it was just opened the other day. It was very exciting to find it in the collection. But most visitors left Jerusalem relatively quickly for the countryside, hoping to find along the routes they took remnants that would remind them of biblical narrative. They traveled by horseback, and I show you a view of the road from Jerusalem towards Bethlehem. They traveled by horseback and they camped along the way. Although the Holy Land was rapidly becoming a magnet for package tours and travelers, it was still relatively difficult travel. You traveled by horse or donkey. A rail link from the coast to Jerusalem was only completed in the 1890s. And in fact, the road from Jaffa to Jerusalem was unfinished in many places. It wasn't suitable to take a coach or a carriage along the way. Tourist hotels only appeared in 1869 and then only in Jerusalem and Jaffa. Travel in Palestine meant tenting in Palestine, an experience that some travelers loathed and are quite vociferous about it, and others found the most delightful experience. The goal for most of these groups was to move into and through the land. If shrines were suspect, the footpaths and valleys were not. The thrill for visitors was to walk where the prophets and apostles had walked, to see a landscape unchanged from the land they had read or heard about. It was perhaps easier to relate to this landscape, familiar to them, as the Dean of Westminster, Dean Stanley, suggests, because it was part of the rhetoric of their life. And I quote him, he says, "The passage of the Red Sea, the murmurings at the water of strife, the passage of the Jordan, the fountains of Silo, are well-known instances in which the local features of the Holy Land have naturally become our household imagery." Photographers recognized this, and they traded on those associations and heightened those identifications. Here, Frank Mason Good photographs the site known as Jacob's Well. And to make it really apparent what you're seeing, he poses suitably garbed shepherds, probably local people that he provides the clothing for, to make the association stronger. And I'm going to quote a bit at length from a traveler's account of 1870, about the same time this photograph was made. In an hour, we were riding through the midst of tall flowers under the shadow of Gerizim and conducted by our guide to a broad, level spot covered with large stones which looked down on a vast plain that stretched away eastward. What place was this? We asked our guide with some impatience. It was Jacob's Well. We confessed to a temporary feeling of extreme disappointment. There was no spot in all Palestine which could so certainly be connected with the presence of the Son of God. We could say with undoubted assurance, on this very spot, Jesus had sat and conversed. From this very point, he had looked forth on scenes on which we were now looking, which were no doubt unchanged in their grand natural features. But while we knew from many travelers that the well had been greatly injured, we were not prepared for such a complete defacement of the old picture as this. Yet hope springs eternal for these visitors, because the very next paragraph, they say, there cannot, however, be any reasonable doubt that this is the actual well of Jacob. The fact is certified by the most clear and uncontradicted tradition coming down in unbroken line from earliest times. The place corresponds with the topography in the book of Genesis of the parcel of land before, that is, to the east of the city of Sichem, in which Jacob pitched his tent when he first came. A look at the country teeming everywhere with inexhaustible fertility shows the patriarch's skill in the choice of pasture ground, which was free to all, while at the same time the purchased lot with the well in its center, in which he could claim absolute property, was of first importance in being able to carry on his shepherd life. And here it was that the youthful Joseph first came to visit his brothers to see how they did on that memorable occasion when further north at Dothan he was sold to the merchants and borne away to Egypt, one of those apparently insignificant events which changed the history of the world. And in that one passage, you see the reaction, the disappointment, and the recouping of the magic of being in that place. Travels in Palestine were also wonderful if one could reenact, even if in comfortably appointed tents, the Israelites' long encampment in the wilderness of Paran, a photograph again by Frank Mason Good, identified as the wilderness of Paran, the place where the Israelites wandered for 40 years. Now, the photographs we've looked at did double duty. They were purchased by the travelers who came to Palestine and preserved in their family albums, brought out to retell the story of an extraordinary journey or to just remember where they had been. They were also widely distributed beyond the borders of Palestine through books and print sales throughout Europe and North America. In fact, a few of Bonfils' glass plate negatives ended up in Alaska, where an Alaskan native photographer, a graduate student of mine, recognized what they were in a junk shop, purchased them, and has been making prints of them. I mean, that's 150 years later. So the views we've been looking at this afternoon and the many more examples in the exhibition were made for those who had traveled the dusty roads of Palestine, as well as for those who would only visit in their imaginations. Now, those kind of imaginary visits would be exquisitely heightened if the photographs one viewed were seen in stereo. And I hate showing a stereo card because unless you can make your eyes cross, it's not going to pop into three dimensions for you. But essentially, a stereo are two paired images, each taken from a slightly different vantage point, the vantage point that is the distance between the pupil of your eyes. When viewed in a viewer, they will create the sensation of three dimensions. And the exhibition has two simulated stereo viewers, each loaded with a 13-card trip, one around Jerusalem and one around Palestine. The stereo viewers in the gallery, I think more than almost any verbiage that asks you to think yourself into a late 19th century viewer's mind really show you what it was to experience how magical photographs of this region were. The use of the stereos, cards that had very extensive text that followed a particular route and came with maps and books to accompany them, created a sense of actually you physically having traveled through that space, and they were enormously popular. There were literally hundreds of thousands of stereo sets produced in their heyday. I'm going to quote a little bit from the book that accompanies the set that's up in the gallery. The authors are essentially telling you why you should buy this. They say, "The land of Palestine has been called the fifth gospel, and the stereo is invaluable in helping to make that gospel of the Bible real to us. Hence, we first need to know intimately, to see, if possible, the very stone and earth of which those places are composed. Such experiences help us as nothing else can. They are magical in their power to give us a vivid realization of the actuality in the biblical narrative. There is indeed an infinite difference between the picture and the place itself as objective realities. But there need be no essential difference between the ideas and emotions which the picture and the place can produce within us. We are dealing with realities in the stereoscope, but they are the real experiences of seeing Palestine, not the material earth and water and air of Palestine." These were the tropes that directed people in what they saw and how they saw it. And from these tropes come a series of assumptions about control of the space that actually haunt us to this day. In 1868, the Archbishop of Canterbury, addressing a group that is going to undertake mapping and exploration in Palestine, says, "This land belongs to us. It belongs to the British people because of our association with the Bible." This would have enormous repercussions in the 20th century. Even someone who could be quite realistic, like Winston Churchill, would say, "The land of Jacob's might and Isaiah's strain, of Abraham's faith and Emmanuel's love, where God's mysterious ways with man began, and where in the fullness of time it will be completed. It has claims on England, as England has on it." And in the United States, the statements are very much the same. There is a sense that because of an association of biblical rhetoric and political rhetoric, that the landscape belongs in a very real way to these dominant cultures. It shows up in popular culture in the United States through the development of models, scale models of Palestine at Chautauqua that people could walk through, a scale model of Jerusalem that appears in the 1904 World's Fair, and the incredible number of photographs that were produced, sold, and cherished, many of which are in the galleries here and that I hope you enjoy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed your presentation. I don't expect you would have come across a historical picture, but is there a picture anywhere of the Valley of the Shadow of Death?
Ah, that is, you know, the picture of the Valley of the Shadow, or the picture captioned the Valley of the Shadow of Death, is actually in the Crimea. And it's a photograph made of a battle scene by Fenton, with cannon shot scattered around. And it's I thank you for bringing it up, because it shows how a biblical reference gets transported into the Crimean War to connect with an understanding by the British public of what they're seeing. There's nothing in the photographic literature I've seen specifically about Palestine that talks about that location. I think many of the Psalms might still have been read as primarily metaphorical, but Fenton could transplant that idea to the Crimean War and feed it back into the British population.
Hi. Can you talk a little bit more about the relationship between paintings and photographs? And because this seems to be a class of people making these tours that would certainly have been familiar with the Orientalist painting traditions in France and England. And while photographs have this element of truth to them, a scientific truth, the paintings would have an element of moral truth, or, you know, kind of something that would certainly be in conversation with this burgeoning collection of photographs that was now competing visually with the kind of truthfulness embedded in painting.
Yeah, that's a good question. Because painters at the time were also using photographs to create their paintings, that if you look in the studio of someone like Jerome, one of the Orientalists, you can see pegged on his wall photographic views from the Holy Land. There's a difference in market and a difference that has to do with the relative cost. One could acquire a photographic album or photographs for your album relatively cheaply. If you had the resources, you might also acquire a painting. But the photographs, because of that sense of what you're seeing was what was in front of the lens, it hasn't been mediated by an artist who might have added color or changed things, that seems to be much closer, more closely allied to this sense of understanding the Bible through textual analysis, through physical geographic analysis, and then having it embedded in the photographs. It was real. There are connections in American painting that John Davis has pointed out between how the Holy Land was presented in literature, in photographs, and in painting. But the Orientalist paintings didn't get a huge, didn't have a huge impact in kind of a growing middle class America, for example. They might have been collected by wealthy collectors. They might have been seen by people visiting the academies in Paris or in London, but they didn't have that kind of, you know, this is in my aunt's sitting room and I can look through it, this kind of intimacy that that photography developed just because it was so pervasive.
Tell me about picture postcards.
Picture postcards have an interesting history all of their own. They are, the use of a photograph on a postcard really dates from about the late 1880s, and there are a few examples that I've seen from this region of the world. But I think you're also looking at the way a collection predetermines the type of stuff that they collect. A museum will collect prints, exhibition prints. The Getty Research Institute, whose major holdings in this type of photography come from a personal collection that they acquired, one put together by Ken Jacobson, was again focused on the quality of the print. So there are picture postcards. They did circulate. Most of the commercial photographers were very canny, canny businessmen. So they would create a lot of different ways that you could purchase their works. Small pictures, picture postcards, big mammoth plate prints, stereo cards. Frith traveled with three different cameras. If he was going to set up a scene, he photographed it in every format he had and sold it that way. It's a really very, very nuanced understanding of market.
That's actually quite a good segue to my question, which is a process question. This environment is harsh, and you know, the equipment that they were working with and the media that they were using and so-called chemicals, they were natural materials, I think. How did they manage to deal with that and have, you know, deal with breakdowns and replace parts and whatever?
One of the things that's good about a primitive technology is because it's, As things get more complicated, there are more things to break. So essentially, cameras were pretty simple. They were big, light, tight wood boxes. And you put the film you had, the negative substrate you had prepared, whether it was paper or glass, in a pretty solid negative holder, stuffed it in the camera. Lenses were not multifocal, multi-element lenses. You had the lens you had. You didn't have exposure controls. You took the lens cap off, you looked at your watch, you put the lens cap back on. So breakdowns weren't much of a problem, unless the burrow fell over and broke all your glass plates. And then I guess you were just out of luck. But it was difficult. Francis Frith writes about making photographs in Egypt where it was so hot that the material, the collodion that he used to coat the glass plate negatives, boiled off the plates as he was trying to pour it over it. And others talk about the problem with getting water that was clean enough to be able to wash a negative. And probably for every exquisitely exposed and printed photograph, there were probably hundreds that were pretty shoddy-looking examples because all of those factors were so difficult to allow for. An exhibition I did quite a while ago with a colleague, we were showing paper negatives because they're pretty magical. They're the same size as the picture, and you almost get this transformation to a night view. And she wanted to make some paper negatives. So she pulled up all of the literature from France, from England, about how to do it, started working with her camera, and she found out that if it was humid, it was totally different than if it were dry. It wasn't just the amount of sunlight. It was an extraordinarily frustrating process. I think it took her 2 weeks to get one good negative we could show. I have a little problem sometimes with calling. These are absolutely highly skilled makers of visual images. Most of them did not consider themselves artists. Most of them were commercial operators. And certainly they are masterpieces of their process in their time. But they don't have the same, to me, intentionality and investment that I would put with someone who painted or did a sketch. But that's probably quibbling.
I had a question. You talked about most of these people taking the photos being kind of like Christian pilgrims from Britain and the United States. Mm-hmm. Are there a lot of photos taken by other people that have a similar cultural identity to the region?
No.
Like Jews from the diaspora or...
Yeah, that's interesting because the exhibition you see, and the photographs, for the most part, that exist from the area represent a very particular slice of experience of that place. It is primarily Protestant, primarily British, North American, and French, but there was Reverend Graham taught one Jewish resident of the city how to make photographs, Mendel Dinnis. And his prints were just discovered maybe in the last 15 years. But there isn't a photographic presence by the Muslim inhabitants. There aren't Jewish photographic studios until very, very late, into the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. Some of the surveys were supported by European Jews. Sir Moses Montefiore underwrote a lot of the photographs, and people would photograph the people of the city, including the Jews. But it really is this particular look. It's not a pilgrimage visit. It's a tourist visit, something not a requirement of religious observation, but leisure travel that connects with religious experience. So there's a real difference, and it is close to impossible to represent the city from the viewpoint of 90% of the people in it.
Thank you for the talk. By the 1870s and 1880s, there are already large-scale neighborhoods that exist outside the walls of the old city, both particularly to the west and to the north. And I'm wondering if the professional photographers of this time showed the same or any interest, or what level of interest was there for those neighborhoods that rested outside the old city?
Yeah. Not much is the answer. Again, it's that very nuanced understanding of what your market wants. And your market wants the old city, and it wants picturesque people. There isn't a market for showing, for example, the entire bureaucratic apparatus that runs the city. That doesn't appear in pictures. There is, however, a great market for anyone you could have in a headscarf and by the side of the road. So there's this real expectation of what people were looking for there and providing it. I think one of the reasons tourists bought so many of the photographs is because they were conditioned to look for this vision of the Holy Land that photographs had presented. As they traveled, especially in the late 1880s and 1890s, that vision is not there as much. You know, they're not getting back into the little streets of Jerusalem because it's scary and you might meet someone foreign. They're in the tourist hotels, but they're going to buy the photographs of it. So you get this very complicated mediating of their experience. Now, when they go home and show those photographs in the album, I suspect they say, oh, yes, it's just like this. We saw it. And dropped out is the fact that there's a huge Russian Orthodox church and pilgrimage site that is just on the other side of the frame, because we don't want to notice that. It's like many people's tourist photographs. Don't show the gas station.
Thank you for a wonderful presentation and a great exhibit. I'm wondering a couple of things. You mentioned North America, but I didn't hear any specific photographers mentioned, and I wondered whether they were represented in the 1870 to 1910 period. And secondly, I wondered whether any of the travels were supported, funded by the press during this period, whether Mark Twain went with an examiner photographer, for example.
No.
Or, last question,
yeah.
Whether this, in fact, did lead to an interest or generated press coverage in throughout the world in any way.
Yeah, those are good questions. There certainly were a few Americans, but it was much easier to take a P&O steamship from France or from Great Britain and set up as a photographer there. And so the bulk of the people who have a long time commercial practice specifically in the area are people from Europe, or actually from the Ottoman Empire. Sabah and Joyeux set up there as well. But there are some amateur photographers. Their pictures are not obviously as widely disseminated. You could, if you were really dedicated, travel with dry plate negatives and make some pictures, and that does happen, but not very much. Photographs could only be reproduced in newspapers after 1888, when they had the halftone screen process. Before then, it would be taking a photograph and literally copying it in a wood engraving so it could be locked up with type and printed. So you would just get the best commercial photograph you could find and do that. There's enormous press coverage of biblical scholarship. Many of the New York, the Philadelphia, the London papers had a recurring column that reported on what would seem like they were pretty arcane textual researches into Syriac manuscripts versus manuscripts in Aramaic. There is this kind of interest in this scientific exploration of the Bible. I mean, there are best-selling books, the historical Christ, all of the travel books. So there's an interest, but most of the images, unless you got a photograph yourself, were illustrated with engravings, just because of the ease of printing.